Earlier I said that Michael Esalen serves as the chaplain for the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. He has worked extensively in oncology, hospice, palliative care, and with acute psychiatric patients. He's been invited many times to speak to students, doctors, nurses, social workers, and faith communities about his work as a chaplain on death and dying, and the spiritual dimension of the cancer experience. Michael is also a co-founder and chair of a nonprofit volunteer anti-homophobia speakers bureau called GLIDE, Gays and Lesbians Initiating Dialogue for Equality. Today's sermon is called Putting on the Gold Coat. Are we defined by what we do? And what does that say about inherent worth and dignity? Let us welcome Michael Esalen.
Thank you, and good morning. And thank you for having me back again. It's always a pleasure to come here. Recently, after speaking to another congregation, I was greeting folks after the service, and this man approached me and was sharing with me how he'd come to align himself with Unitarian Universalism. However, he continues to struggle with one of our core principles, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Well, I was kind of shocked by that, because to me that was always a no-brainer. I mean, like, duh, dude, of course that's true. Like, world peace is a good idea. But the more he talked, and I honestly reflected, I thought, you know, I've glossed over that principle a little too easily myself. In his view, there were people who had done such horrible things, or maybe people who hadn't done horrible things, but they just weren't good, kind people, and that didn't speak to any particular inherent worth or dignity. So I tried to explore with him the distinction between worth and dignity and good and evil. Awkward at best to attempt such a conversation in such a setting, but there you are. Still, those two notions do dance very closely together. And all of this isn't so terribly far removed from more Christian notions about God's grace. I wonder if what hung him up in his mind was really that word inherent, that somehow worth and dignity had to be proven or earned. As much as I'd like to think this is a core value and principle for me, the fact is I've judged myself very harshly throughout my life based on what I did or did not do. And very often, though I'm loath to admit it, based on how much money I made, or more likely didn't make, though I'd like to think I know better. And of course, a big part of me does know better, but the fact remains there have been times in my life when in my own mind, my very right to exist, to take up space on the planet, depended on it, my ability to make money. Yeah, I'm really down with that inherent worth and dignity thing. And look at how much cultural reinforcement there is for this value that would say you are what you do. You meet somebody for the first time, and what's the second or third question you're going to ask them? So what do? With some professions, we even attach a title to our very names based on what we do. Doctor or reverend. A number of years ago, when I was laid off from my job at the time as the palliative care chaplain at Santa Monica UCLA Hospital, I was struggling so with, among other things, how to respond to very well-meaning people in my life who seemed to incessantly ask, so what are you going to do now? What are you going to do now? What are you going to do now? My therapist at the time suggested telling them, I'm engaged in a spiritual practice of letting go. Now, as loopy as that might sound, there really is a profound truth there. Are we really no more than our deeds? Look at how we construct an obituary. A resume, basically, to describe a person's life and their essence, wife, mother, teacher, architect. Even without the limitations of a few lines in an obituary, how would we describe our lives and our essence? Would it still just be a list of some kind? What we loved, what we lost, our victories, our defeats? Would it depend on the day you asked us? Is our identity even really fixed? Or in the end, does it really come down to you are what you did in life? And where's the inherent worth and dignity in that? As an oncology chaplain, I have met hundreds of patients who have watched their very identities and sense of themselves crumble right before their eyes, when cancer robbed them of the ability to do the thing that they thought once defined them. Do they cease to exist in that moment? Has their worth and dignity been lost or misplaced for a time? Carla was a devoted mother with two little girls, and her whole life, her world revolved around those girls and their activities. When breast cancer robbed her of the ability to attend the soccer games and the birthday parties, she felt a crushing sense of defeat as a mother. Does she cease to be the mom in that moment? Is she no longer a good parent? We looked at how she was still being the mom, teaching perhaps the ultimate lessons any of us will ever have to learn. How to love, how to face crisis and loss, and how to let go. Luther was this proud African-American man in his mid-60s, facing the end of his days from pancreatic cancer. He was also a lifelong Pentecostal preacher and pastor. When the social worker made that referral to me and gave me that little snapshot of Luther, I felt a little panicky. How on earth am I going to make a connection with somebody like that? It took a little while for his humanity to peek out from behind all of his platitudes, but ultimately he said, "Chaplain Michael, do you want to know what the hardest thing of all is about this? It's to realize my congregation is going to go on without me. And they're going to be just fine. I always saw them as my flock, and I was their shepherd, indispensable. But I'm nobody's minister anymore." I told him he was still being a minister to me, perhaps from a different kind of pulpit, but showing me how to meet inevitable loss with humanity, with humility, and with grace. Some folks, they feel trapped, condemned forever to make up for what they perceive as the absence of worth and dignity. Miguel was this elegant Spanish gentleman in his mid-50s with lung cancer. He'd grown up in a highly accomplished, well-to-do Spanish family and was highly accomplished himself, from where I stood anyway. He was an expert in Middle Eastern cultures and languages, a professor, author, lecturer, spoke several languages fluently. But it wasn't enough. "Michael," he said, "when I die, there should be only two words on my tombstone, mediocrity and will," he said with some disgust. "Why would you say that?" I asked. "Because if I've achieved anything in my life at all, as meager as it is, it's only because of sheer will. When I was a little boy, I used to prick myself with a pin until I drew blood just to stay awake so I could study harder." Where does that kind of self-loathing come from? That lack of capacity to recognize one's own value just for being oneself. Are we really no more than our deeds, the best or the worst of them? Look at Lance Armstrong. What to make of all that? He has inspired untold millions with his story, with his victories. I've met dozens of patients so inspired by his book. He creates a foundation. And now with this news of doping, he's lost the very platform he had from which to inspire. So does that negate and nullify all the inspiration he gave? It'll be interesting to see, I think, as his fall from grace unfolds, if he might offer in time a whole other kind of inspiration of just what it means to be a human being in darkness and in light. A number of years ago, I worked in the liver transplant unit, and there I co-facilitated a weekly support group for folks waiting for livers as their last hope of survival. And there I met Hugo, who was this dapper Latino gentleman, very charming, in his mid-50s, always sporting a snappy hat, featuring a little bling, with these tattoos peeking out from his cuff and collar that hinted at a more, shall we say, rambunctious youth in East L.A., where he'd grown up. Hugo was waiting for his second liver. His first liver transplant had failed. As he grew sicker, he needed to be hospitalized, deteriorating by the day. I went to see him one afternoon, and with some urgency, he said he needed to make a confession to a Catholic priest. I told him I'd page Father Tom right away, our staff priest, and he said, "No, Michael, that won't do. This sin is so terrible, I can only confess it to the parish priest at the church in East L.A. where I grew up." I sat and I listened to this scared, broken man, desperate to unburden his conscience, and I felt the most tender affection and compassion for him. I wanted to make this happen, and I wanted him to know some peace. When I left work that afternoon, I got in my car, turned on the radio, And I heard a news story about some drunk driver in downtown L.A. who just wiped out maybe a dozen people. My instant response internally was, kill the bastard. I don't know what Hugo had done, but I imagine it was something pretty terrible. But in that moment, it didn't matter. At the bedside, it was sacred. There was worth and dignity. And there was definitely grace. A few hours later, in the car, I had no such capacity to recognize those qualities in the drunk driver. So it makes me wonder what role forgiveness plays in our ability to recognize worth and dignity. On one hand, it would seem essential, but I find forgiveness to be a very prickly word. I don't know exactly what it means and looks like in all of its permutations. Margaret has survived years of abuse at the hands of her husband, and now she's facing the end of her life from breast cancer. Michael, I know God won't forgive me unless I can forgive others, but I just can't forgive my husband, no matter how hard I try. Do you think I'm condemned? And Doris survived years of sexual assault at the hands of her own father. And yet, in her view, God demands that I forgive my father. If I harbor any resentment or anger or bitterness toward him at all, it's as grave a sin as his molestation of me. I hear that and I think, what a debilitating burden. What a barrier to experiencing grace for oneself. A grace that would be large enough and merciful enough to have room for her anger. I suspect that for many of us, our capacity to recognize worth and dignity isn't quite as inherent as we might like to think, that it may be very much attached to ideas about proving and earning. Corinne has survived 10 years with metastatic breast cancer, and yet she confides in me and confesses that I feel guilty for being alive, when so many women I've met along the way have long since died. She runs herself ragged doing volunteer work to the detriment of her own well-being, chasing after this elusive worth. And Wilma has devoted much of her life to serving the disadvantaged, the homeless mostly, as a volunteer, and all that's inspired out of her Christian faith. But now she has a very aggressive ovarian cancer, and she needs help. She needs help from her husband, from her family, her church community. But what grieves Wilma? I can't pay anybody back. I can't do anything for anybody. Isn't that terrible? It was impossible for her to imagine that people might be showing up for her just because they love her, not because of anything she's done or can do. Even more inconceivable to Wilma, the idea that maybe just being Wilma is payback enough for everybody. I read the most moving story in the New York Times about a year ago about this program at the California Men's Colony, a maximum security prison up near San Luis Obispo. The program attempts to address this overwhelming and ever-growing problem of dementia among an aging prisoner population. How to care for these men. So as a cost-saving strategy, the prison is recruiting and training younger inmates to be the aides and caregivers for the older inmates. Gold coats, they're called. Because of the yellow jackets they wear to stand out among the standard issue blue coveralls. The gold coats tend to all the most personal needs of the older inmates. They feed them. They protect them. They make sure other prisoners don't steal their food or the dessert. They tend to the most intimate matters of personal hygiene. They clean up after inevitable bodily mishaps. They get in the shower with them. Now, both men on either side of this relationship have often committed the most unspeakable crimes imaginable. If they had any claim to inherent worth and dignity, it would seem they have forfeited it long ago. And for the gold coat, there's no hope of brownie points here. There's no possibility of early parole or commuted sentence. Only the possibility of the experience of compassion for choosing to engage in this dance of the condemned. This image moves me beyond words. Two condemned souls, and one chooses to put on the gold coat for no other reason than, as one of them put it, allowing me to feel human. Can the gold coat be a pathway for us to see beyond our own judgment and condemnation of others or of ourselves? Speaking for myself, upon reflection and many of the patients I've served over the years, I think a fair number of us have spent some time in those blue coveralls of the condemned, condemned by our own internal judges, metaphorically speaking, some of us maybe for a lifetime. One thing I love about this image of the gold coat is that the blue jumpsuit, the conviction, the crime, doesn't come off. Nothing's been forgiven, whatever that means. Nothing's been erased. The blue jumpsuit stays, and we just put the gold coat on over it and do the kind thing anyway. So in reflecting on how we judge ourselves, the opportunity is there, the invitation, even if the blue jumpsuit never comes off our whole life, we can always choose to put on the gold coat and tend to that which is broken and scared and weak and frightened and guilty with kindness. Tend to it within ourselves, tend to it within each other. I was raised a Catholic, and so I was taught there's a hierarchy of sins. Some sins are worse than others, that murder is worse than telling a lie. Protestants tend to view that a little differently. What I have found when reflecting on how I've judged myself and observe others judging themselves, the size of the sin doesn't seem to matter a bit to that internal judge. He won't be convinced and he won't be silenced. I don't think we have to have committed the grievous crimes of the imprisoned in order to imprison ourselves with judgment. I mentioned earlier that I have struggled at times in my life between the correlation between money and worth and dignity. As a chaplain, I don't make enough money to support myself. And my partner Scott generously subsidizes my life and my pursuits. That particular circumstance has been far more challenging to accept than I care to admit. Not for Scott, mind you, it's all me. As much as I'd like to think otherwise, I suppose I'm not impervious to cultural values that would say a man's worth, his dignity, his success, his manhood is tied to how much money he makes. So when I make a mistake, one that costs money to remedy, you cannot believe the internal condemnation. Last year, in the span of about a month, I got not one, not two, but three parking tickets. $56 a pop for forgetting to hang the permit placard from my rearview mirror parking in front of our own house. I do not exaggerate to say at the time it felt like I don't deserve to live. I was mortified, humiliated to have to tell Scott. And it didn't matter one bit that his response would be, "So, you're human, you made a mistake," or three, "Let it go." I was embarrassed by the amount of suffering I was causing myself. But the fact is, a core wound had been touched. The wound of inherent worthlessness. Not so different from Miguel, who used to prick himself with a pin just to stay awake and study harder. So carelessness when I'm being supported financially, unforgivable. Maybe I'm a Protestant after all. But as I have judged myself, so it is that I have judged others. Geez, the hours in therapy dissecting the sins of the Father, for instance. But just as we might hold ourselves and each other hostage for committing the smallest of sins, so it is that the smallest of deeds might just be a pathway to our own redemption and offering that redemption to others. How ironic, but the crazy paradox remains that what we do can be a window, if not the very proof of, what was always inherent all along. A couple years ago, Janet died, who was an old friend of the family and my mom's best friend. We all gathered in Long Beach, where I was born and raised, for her memorial service. I'd grown up with her kids, but I hadn't seen them in well over 40 years. Still, I could see traces of the children they were dance across their eyes and their smiles. After the service, pulled into the undertow of nostalgia and reflection, we took my mom on a tour of Long Beach, revisiting landmarks from our lives. And from her life as a teenage Midwest transplant during World War II. Of course, many of the landmarks are long gone, but quite a few remain. Makes me wonder why it gives us so much comfort to find the detritus of our lives exactly where we left it. The last stop on our tour would be the house I grew up in, the house my parents built, the house that's still the setting for so many dreams, the house we left in 1969 after my parents' divorce. My mom, if you can imagine, a young bride of 20, got to help design her dream house with my dad's best boyhood friend who had just graduated from USC architecture school. It was a mid-century modern gem. And my mom, just a moment, it was this kind of a gem. Like so many of the landmarks, though, the house has been obliterated by a lot of bad additions and remodels. But quite a few remnants remain. I screwed up the courage to go up to the front door, now covered by a grotesque wrought iron security gate. And I knocked, and I heard the inner door open, but I couldn't see through the mesh as if it were a confessional. I'm so sorry to disturb you, but I grew up in this house, and my parents built this house, and my mom's 82 years old, and she's out in the car right now, and she lives 200 miles away, and it'd mean the world to her and to us. If we could come in and look around just for a minute. Sure, he said flatly. Young kid, Cambodian, maybe 21 or 2. From the way he talked, it didn't sound like it was his parents' house. Maybe he was extended family or a boarder. In any event, he was home alone. I gulped for air as I watched my mom walk up the steps to her own house. In an instant, I could see her as she once was, glamorous, high heels clicking on the flagstone, coming home from PTA. And as she is today, with tears in her eyes, she slowly walked to the front door with a kind of reverence, as if she's walking up to an altar, ready to receive Holy Communion. Once inside, it was as if we were floating in this zero-gravity chamber without any anchor in time or space. We made our way to my parents' bedroom, the spot where I was conceived. And my mom's first words were, "Oh, God, the fights your father and I had in this room." Telling and sad. We rounded the corner into my parents' bathroom and another gasp. "Oh, my God, the same blue fixtures, the same blue sink, the same blue toilet, the same square plexiglass cabinet pulls with the beveled edges and the polished chrome centers." And then my mom cried out, "Oh, my God, my mirror." And she began to sob. Hard. My dad had made a wedge of plywood and mounted it on the wall opposite my mom's vanity mirror. And on the slanted side of the wedge, he affixed a mirror so she could stand in front of the mirror and see the back of her head to comb her hair. "How many times I've thought about that mirror over the years and wished I had it," she cried. "And he built it for me. I asked him and he built it for me. And it's still here. And he's not." And something was healed in that moment. For her and for me, in the span of a few moments, we went from recalling these arguments to the most tender affection and gratitude for what was likely the full extent and limit and beauty, really, of my father's love, solving a concrete problem. That's what he could do. That's what he could offer. Not done with any great style or attention to detail, mind you, but it was sturdy. My mom has lost so much vision to macular degeneration, and she stood there in front of the mirror trying to see the back of her head. And instead, she saw love and forgiveness. And I caught a glimpse of inherent worth and dignity. Some view in that mirror. Maybe what we do can be a window or a mirror into what was always inherent all along. Maybe what's required is our willingness to put on a gold coat before we look and allow ourselves to feel human and all that that may mean in darkness and in light. May we all gaze into that mirror and see that reflection of ourselves and each other as we are and as we are not, with grace. So be it.